And welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. This is an hour of mind power. It's a great way to start your day and to brighten up your life. And we always have so many unique and interesting people on the air. Now, by the way, don't forget, with the Donna Sebo Show, you always want to have a pad of paper and a pen handy. First, I'd like you to note our toll-free number that you'll be able to call into later on in the show. That is 877-876-5227. Well, in the U.S. of A., we all have unique backgrounds. I often call myself, I can't say it's a Heinz 57, but I guess it could be that, because I know I have a mixed background myself. And our guest today has such a wonderful book, and it's titled Being Japanese American. And it's a J.A. Source book for Nikki Hapa and their friends. It's Mr. Gil Asakawa. Gil, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Donna.
I'm so delighted to have you as a guest. When I first became aware of your book and then had the opportunity to read through it, I was fascinated with the way you were able to put together so much history. You were able to draw so much in the way of information out, bringing so much detail about the various generations of Japanese-American. And I thought, gee whiz, this is something that makes for fascinating reading, number one. And number two, it gives one a whole different way of looking at a culture that many times, many individuals don't even have a chance to explore. And you are a Sansi who lives in Arvada, Colorado, and you love cats, I understand, and you've been in the news media, you've written for newspapers, magazines, and websites, you've co-authored another book, you have a column that people can view online, and we'll find out about your website later on. But Gil, why did you feel that this was important for you to give this information? I have to chuckle, and before you answer it, I loved your introduction. You said you were told you were a banana, yellow on the outside and white on the inside. I just loved that at the beginning of the book.
Well, and it's true, and the reason is totally that even though I was born in Japan, my dad was from Hawaii and was in the U.S. military when he met my mom during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
Once we moved to the United States, we didn't have Japanese friends, and I didn't. My parents did, but I didn't grow up around Japanese friends, and going through school and high school, and even into college, I thought of myself pretty much as a white kid, except for the times when some racist person would make a remark at me, and then I'd be reminded that I guess my skin color and my eyes are different. But my experience was as an all-American kid growing up in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't occur to me that I had, even while I was growing up this way, inside the house at home, I took my shoes off. My mom cooked Japanese food. My mom spoke almost all Japanese to me. And I would answer her in English. And we had a lot of Japanese culture all around me. And so it just never, I took those things for granted. And
mm-hmm.
In my outside public life, I was totally like any other Caucasian kid, leave it to Beaver type of kid. And so it was really in the 1990s, after my dad passed away of cancer, that I started getting interested in kind of my ethnic roots. And even though I could cook Japanese food and I, loved Japanese restaurants and Japanese culture, I never really thought of myself as being that connected to it until then. And so this book was really a way for me to explore my own identity within American society. And the bottom line is that Asian Americans in general and Japanese Americans certainly are practically invisible. We're like, the model minority, and we do well, and we work hard, and we get good grades.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not often kind of celebrated in this kind of way, like in a book. And I think a lot of that is because people look at me and they assume I'm Japanese. And the one thing that I discovered when I wrote this book is that being Japanese American is definitely not being Japanese. Japanese Americans are very different from Japanese people. mostly because most Japanese American families have roots where, you know, great grandparents came to the U.S. in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Japanese culture they identify with is very old. You know, it's like old-fashioned. So a lot of Japanese Americans, you know, the Japanese language that they speak, the culture that they know, the dances and songs and things, they're all like 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like Rip Van Winkle waking up 100 years later, and all of a sudden, you know, people around here are going, what? You know, if Japanese Americans go to Japan today, you know, people in Japan think we're quaint and odd because we don't speak the same language. You know, we don't
mm-hmm.
really identify.
Right, because you were raised in a much different world.
Right.
And you say it very well. Your book is entertaining in my mind's view.
It's
also refreshing, but it gives an insight into the variables that come from, you know, different cultural backgrounds. And I like what you said, that your brain had settled into a groove that allowed Japanese and American stuff to live side by side. You wouldn't even think about it. It wouldn't be a duality, really. It's just there.
No, there wasn't a conflict.
Not a conflict at all. But I loved what you said when you decided you were going to be a laid-back SM disc jockey. And you would say, "Hello, everybody. I'm Gil Asakawa, the teriyaki cosmic cowboy."
Yeah, it's a very embarrassing time of my life now when I think about it. It was like I was making fun of myself, and I didn't even notice it. I had a great poster that I made for myself that was very colorful.
My. Well, I just think it's absolutely awesome. Now, there are distinct terms that describe Japanese Americans, and correct my pronunciation if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Sansi, Yonsei, Gosi, and Rokusei.
Yeah, people tend to know the word Nisei because the Nisei were the second generation. If you know any Japanese, it's Ichi, Ni, San, Shi, Go, Roku are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So the Issei, the first generation, were the Japanese who came to the U.S. The Nisei were the first generation who were born in the U.S. They were actually American citizens. And a lot of people know the word Nisei because the Nisei are commonly referred to as the generation that were locked up in the internment camps during World War II. The Sansei are third generation, and I happen to be a Sansei because my dad was born in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though he's full-blooded, you know, Japanese, he was born in Hawaii, so that made him a Nisei. So that makes me a Sansei, even though I was born in Japan. And the Yonsei is fourth generation. And Gosei is fifth generation. And now Rokusei is sixth generation. And you're starting to see fourth, fifth, and sixth generation Japanese Americans now. They're, you know, they're kids, they're high school students. And they're very, very Americanized. And I'm pleased to see that, and actually, in a lot of cases, these later generations are more interested in their Japanese heritage than, like, their Sansei parents, Sansei or Yonsei parents were. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact of the internment. That my wife, for instance, her parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents were all interned
mm-hmm.
during World War II. And in many families where that happened, they came out of the war minimizing their identity. A lot of Japanese-American families in the 50s and 60s didn't allow Japanese to be spoken in the house, you know, kept their shoes on in the house, wouldn't even cook Japanese food in the house because of a fear
mm-hmm.
that unless you were all American, you might get locked up again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of older Japanese Americans have a real hard time even discussing that part of their lives, even today.
I wouldn't be surprised at that, because I know that many older generations of many different experiences, of hardship especially, because of the association with war, that's often something they're very reticent to
yep.
communicate about. So they're just from another side of another coin. I can identify with what you are saying there. Now, for those of you just tuning into the show, we're talking with Gil Asakawa. His wonderful book is Being Japanese American. It's a JA source book for Niki Hapa and their friends. And it really is wonderful, wonderful reading. You make a statement I agree with 100%, that all Americans, Asian or otherwise, came from someplace else. Mm-hmm. And that is so true. I know it's in my own family. Now, my father was from Italy, but he came over here because his father worked to come over. So everybody in the U.S. of A. is some way or another associated with an immigrant at some point in their family history.
Right. And immigrant experiences are actually very similar. There's a lot
mm-hmm.
of shared experiences in there, especially in the late 20th century, the experiences of Asian Americans. You know, after the war, you know, there have been, all through the 20th century, there are waves of Asian immigrants. You know, there were Chinese at first, and there were Japanese, and then there were Filipinos and Indians, and after the Korean War, there were Koreans. And
mm-hmm.
it's interesting that a lot, you know, and then after the Vietnamese War, there's Vietnamese and Cambodian and Thai, and it's after every conflict, it seems like there's a new wave of people, primarily refugees, that come to America because it's such a great country to come to.
Right, and they have an opportunity
mm-hmm.
to make a life that they otherwise would not have.
Right.
I mean, it's so true. Now, the very first Japanese visitor to America, I mean, this really flabbergasted me. How did you find out about him being the very first, and what's his name?
Manjiro Nakahama. And when, because his name was hard to pronounce, when he came to the U.S., they just called him John Manjiro.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a fisherman who was shipwrecked and rescued by a sea captain on a whaler ship from Massachusetts. And so at a very young age, this was in the, what, I think, 1850s?
Yes, 1841.
John Manjiro was brought to the U.S., educated in English, learned, you know, all the American ways of the time, and became a whaler himself. And he actually happened to go back to Japan just at the time, you know the movie Last Samurai?
Mm-hmm.
At the time when Japan was becoming modernized and allowing Westerners to come in, John Manjiro, at the time that John Manjiro returned to Japan, he was imprisoned because it was illegal to leave Japan and go visit any other country.
Right.
But when the Americans came and the Japanese realized, we have to reach out to these people, John Manjiro became a hero.
mm-hmm.
He became a government employee and helped really pave the way for a lot of the early policies and negotiations between the two countries. I had never heard of him. I found out about him when I was fortunate enough to go on a goodwill exchange trip to Japan, sponsored by the Manjiro Society, which is a nonprofit that's based both in the U.S. and in Japan. And every other year they hold a conference, a grassroots summit, 1 year in Japan, 1 year in the U.S., where they invite, you know, regular citizens to go
mm-hmm.
and learn about each other's countries. And it's a great opportunity, and it's done in the spirit of John Manjiro, the first Japanese to visit the U.S.
I know that at the same time that all of this was happening with Mr. John Mung, I also am aware that an American who was from the Northwest, his name was Ronald McDonald, was in Japan just prior to Commodore Matthew Perry coming in. And he is revered by the Japanese. They have a monument to him in Oregon because he's the first American that went into Japan when they had all of those you can't come in parameters.
Right.
And his story is phenomenal.
I had
the chance to see that information and then to have this correlation about what was going on. History is so fascinating.
It is
marvelous. There's so many things going on at the same time.
There were. If you look at, you know, how the world was evolving at the time, it's amazing how things line up. I mean, at the time when Japan was just evolving and becoming westernized, the Civil War was happening, you know, in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really look at the global picture, it's just fascinating. History is always fascinating that way. And, you know, it's my love for history that led me to writing this book.
Well, you've done an incredible job because there's just so much wonderful information. Now, you give some information regarding immigration, and there's a couple points. The immigration law of 1924 stopped Japanese from entering the country, and then after 1924, the only individuals who could go to Japan in return were American-born citizens, the Nisei, and then the Immigration and Nationalization Act of 1952, and then also there was another change after that. Tell us about those changes that evolved, because that really created a big shift.
Well, the history of Asian immigration to the U.S. is really a history of U.S. racist attitudes towards Asians, to be blunt.
Mm-hmm.
From the very start, the Chinese were the first to come to the U.S. in after the 1850s during the Gold Rush era. And at every point when Americans, or I should say European Americans, who already, you know, were the kind of the mainstream, felt threatened by each wave of Asian immigration, they would construct new laws to either keep them out, or from the very start, no Asians were allowed to be citizens. So the reason the Japanese started coming in the 1880s was that there was a law that prohibited any more immigration of Chinese to the U.S. because it was, decided that the Chinese were undesirable and that they had taken over certain industries, and European Americans wanted to keep those industries like railroad work and whatnot. And so they decided that the Japanese would be better workers. So they allowed Japanese to come in. And the country of Japan was happy to send Japanese emigrants to the U.S. because there was a horrible economy and a drought going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan needed to send people to other places to be more productive. And so they did that. Well, by the early 20th century, the Japanese were targets of racist attacks and accusations. And, of course, they couldn't be citizens because they weren't allowed to be citizens. But by then, they were having kids. And those kids, by the nature of being born in the U.S., were citizens by
mm-hmm.
birth.
Mm-hmm.
And so by 1924, actually, there were a whole history of legislation, especially in states like California, that prohibited ownership of land and property by Asian Americans, and specifically Japanese. And by 1924, they just cut off immigration altogether. At one point, they cut off the immigration of men and only allowed women. But then, of course, that meant that there more kids were being born in the U.S. So
mm-hmm.
they just cut off the immigration entirely. The post-war history of immigration of Asians is that little by little, more Asians were allowed to come in. But even up until the 1960s and 70s, the quotas, and the U.S. has quotas on
mm-hmm.
immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And the quotas have always been that a lot fewer Asians are allowed in than other races. And so, like European countries. And so it wasn't, I think, until the late 60s. And my family moved from Japan to the U.S. in 1966. I think it was right after that immigration was fairly normalized from Asia or from Japan. The irony of that is that today, although a lot of Japanese are allowed to come to the U.S., very few Japanese immigrate to the U.S. anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rather stay in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the customs, and for those of you listening, this book is Being Japanese American by Gil Asakawa. It's a wonderful book, and it not only does he cover history, but he has so many, I think, fun things throughout his book regarding cultural words and different patternings. Now, I really enjoyed the information that you gave about food customs and various superstitions that are in Japan, and I found it so interesting. And a couple of them is never stick chopsticks into your rice standing up, because it's done only at funerals when rice is placed on the altar.
Yep.
When eating, your chopsticks should be laid across your rice bowl or your shawan.
Yep.
And then just all kinds of different things and gifts. One of your statements is, when you go to Japan, you leave your American habits at home. Now, being Japanese-American, when you go into Japan, is this something that's easy for you to do?
I think it's easier for me than a lot of Japanese-Americans because I was born in Japan and I was 8 when we moved to the States. So my, for one thing, I tend to know more Japanese than a lot of Japanese-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And for another, I have memories of, you know, of the Japan from when I was a kid. It's pretty different now. I mean, I left Japan before the first McDonald's or KFC or Pizza Hut showed up there, and now a lot of Japan is very westernized. But a lot of the culture is the same. So, you know, the first thing I do when I go into a business when I visit Japan, and I've only been to Japan a few times in my adult life, is in my stumbling Japanese, I tell them right away, "Hi, I'm Japanese-American, excuse me, my poor Japanese." And people are always really nice and willing to tell me, "Oh, no, your pronunciation is really good." And I think if you say that right away, you're very much accepted. On the other hand, my wife, who is Japanese-American, fourth generation, she can read a little Japanese, but she can't speak as much Japanese as I can or understand as much. So when she visits Japan on a business trip, for instance, people will talk to her because they look at her and assume that she's Japanese, and she has no idea what they're saying, so they assume she's, either handicapped or really, really rude. I've had people in Japan tell me that they could just tell from the way I walk that I'm not Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of make allowances for me, that they know that I'm going to be weird because I'm not Japanese.
A point that you bring out, and again, there's so many of them, is that the women, the Japanese women, traditionally cover their mouths when they laugh. And it's not just the poor dental health of many Japanese, but it's an old Buddhist belief that showing bones is unclean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find that so interesting. It's not that way with the men, but it is with the women.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of... Japan is a very... male-oriented society, and there's still, I think, a lot of, they're not even vestiges, because they're really upfront about their sexism,
mm-hmm.
that even in the workplace, there are obviously a lot more women executives now and managers now than there used to be, and yet even the woman manager is often expected to, serve tea at meetings, where the men won't even get up to try to serve the tea.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, it's a culture that's slow to change. And, I should make the point that I happen to know a lot about this stuff because I love Japan and I'm fascinated by Japan and Japanese culture in a way that a lot of Japanese Americans aren't. I've spoken to a lot of Japanese Americans who've never visited Japan and never want to visit Japan. And a lot of it is because they don't feel they're connected to being Japanese American. But that doesn't mean that they're connected to being, to Japan. Like if you were, I have a very good friend who's German American, in that his great grandparents were from Germany. He's never wanted to go to Germany. He doesn't feel particularly an affinity for German food or anything. And I think a lot of Japanese Americans are that way too. And I
mm-hmm.
just happen to be more kind of connected to Japan than a lot of the Japanese Americans I know.
Well, you have one other thing that I want to mention, and then I want to talk about Mr. Endo. You say, if you're like me, you grew up with a mother or grandmother who yelled at you every time you drizzled a little soy sauce on your rice. That's offensive to Japanese, although a lot of Japanese do it anyway, because it implies the food is boring.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband, I'll share this with you, we were in Hawaii on a business trip, and he went out to have an Asian meal somewhere and ordered rice, and the waitress said to him, would you like some soy sauce? He said, no, thank you, I don't want any. She said, are you sure you don't want some soy sauce? And she kept bringing up the soy sauce. She said, okay, I'll have some soy sauce. She said, that's what all howlies do.
That's hilarious.
So even though he hadn't wanted it, it's just a joke that he shares with a lot of people. Let's talk about Mr. Endo, Momofuku Endo. This man has had an impact on our culture here in America with a food. Tell us about this fascinating history.
Tell me, well, actually remind me, I'm sorry.
Instant ramen.
Oh, you know, I did so much research for the book, and there are things like ramen that I love and like I've consumed all my life, and then I researched specifically for the book, so I forgot his name, but yeah, instant ramen, is that one of the great inventions of modern society?
Oh my goodness, I can remember eating it, daughter eating it, and college kids eat this. I mean, they sell a gazillion cups of this.
It's a staple of not just Japanese culture, but obviously all over the world.
And yes.
A staple of college living for sure. I just, you know, there were lots of stretches when I ate this stuff every day. It was just a smart idea to quick dry ramen noodles. And ramen has an interesting history because it's actually a Japanese pronunciation of lo men, which is Chinese noodles.
Mm-hmm.
So in Japan, when you go to a ramen noodle shop, it's invariably Chinese people that generally will run them because it's a Chinese food. Japanese noodles are udon or soba noodles, the buckwheat noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up eating ramen from ramen shops in Japan, and although they were available at the time, you know, dried instant ramen in Japan in the 60s, we never had the instant stuff in Japan because you can buy the fresh stuff in noodle shops everywhere.
Sure.
Once we moved to the States, that I started having instant, you know, Sapporo Ichiban instant ramen, and it was just a great idea to flash dry the stuff into a little slab, and then package a powdered version of the broth that you can mix up with just some hot water. And gosh, it is so cheap that, you know, even today you can go to a Costco store or wherever,
mm-hmm,
and get them for like 6 or 7 cents a package.
It's amazing. And I know you said here that he got the idea when he was visiting here in the United States, and he saw someone take their ramen and pour it into a cup so that they could eat it with a fork.
Yeah.
And it's like his brainwaves went, aha!
Yeah.
And instant ramen was born, and it comes in all kinds of flavors, and it's just absolutely amazing. You have so much wonderful information in here. You even threw in a couple of recipes, but you go into language and how it's hip to be Japanese, and dealing in the community, and how to scrapbook personal history. I don't care what the person's background is. I think reading your book, Being Japanese American, gives us such wonderful insights, well, along with a lot of good humor, but and some very poignant, special, heart-touching moments. And I think you've done just such an incredible job, Gil. What is your website that people can go to find out more about the history of you, your publications, and also the NikkeiView that you have online?
That is actually the website. It's called NikkeiView.com, and it is Nikkei is the Japanese word for people of Japanese descent outside of Japan. And so it's my online column at www.nikkeiview.com, NikkeiView.com. And it's really, it was for many years a weekly column, and I have to admit for the last year and a half I've been so busy with my day-to-day job that I haven't updated it, but I'm just about to start updating it. I'm just about to add a blog that I've started and add a blog link to that page. But it's a site where I write my impressions of pop culture and politics from my peculiar Asian American perspective.
Well, I think it's good to have people put out their views, their insights. That's what this country is all about, is diversity. And I think it's just delightful you have done such a wonderful job with this excellent book of Being Japanese American. Gil Asakawa has been my guest. Gil, thank you so very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Donna. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure having you. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Don't you go away now. We've got more good things to share.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome, Gil. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Don, you're cutting out.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's me. I have a bit of a bad back right now. I'm moving fairly slow.
I can't understand one word you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's all right. I'll be back right here in a minute.
Yeah, it's coming through totally garbled.
Oh, what is?
Yeah, you're coming through totally garbled. Something's interfering.
It's all right. It's no big deal. Is that better?
A little bit.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, it sounds like you're 10,000 miles away.
Really?
Yes, and when I first connected with you when we came on the show, clear as a bell.
No,
yes, so I hope I'm not cutting out.
No, I don't think so. I'm taking a look at the volume level. You're doing fine.
Good, 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 good. I had two questions I wanted to ask you. One is, I have a guest scheduled in Australia, and because in Australia, at the time that we would be contacting her, it's 4 in the morning, she doesn't. She has a toll-free number that we could have called, but at 4 Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and we've just got so much wonderful information to share with you. By the way, I want to remind you, if you'd like to call in and chat with me today, you can do that at 877-876-5227. And if you're a new listener to the show and you're wondering what I'm talking about, well, I am a psychic, and you're welcome to call in. I'm happy to just take your first name or your initial, share with you the perceptions that I see about you as an individual, and then you're welcome to ask a question. So again, during this next half hour, 877-876-5227 is the telephone number to call into. Now, by the way, I do want to let you know that next week we've got a lineup of guests I know you're going to enjoy. Jerry Winstrom is going to be talking to us about the Inspired Heart. Then we're going to be talking with Bobby DePorter about quantum success, and I know you're all interested in that. And then Dr. Robert Zeev. He is going to be talking about healthy medicine. This is, in my mind's view, a leading-edge publication because it is showing how we as individuals are changing our minds about medicine and about how we need to take care of ourselves and things that we're wanting to implement and change regarding the whole system and attitude regarding medicine. I think you'll find him quite interesting. And then we're going to be talking with Coral Montana in Australia. We're going to be talking about her book, Another Place, Another Time. We're going to be discussing a character from history, Crazy Horse. And then we're going to be talking with Bill Borchert about the Lois Wilson story. Now, this is an especially wonderful book. It's about a woman who was married to the man who started Alcoholics Anonymous. And Lois's story is a fascinating one, and one that I know that, again, you'll enjoy listening to. So we've got a great lineup of guests next week, and we're just going to have such a good time sharing with you. Be sure and tell your friends that right here on bbsradio.com from 11 to noon, you'll be able to hear these wonderful, wonderful people sharing their insights, inspirations, and great experiences. Well, here are some more cute little items that were sent to me. And by the way, I wanted to thank Jessica for sending these little items to me because they're really cute. Very positive, upbeat, humorous statements. But I also want to let you know, if you would like to get my email newsletter or if you have something special you would like to share with me and you're part of the world, maybe something in the way of a story, a personal experience that you feel that would be of interest to me and my listeners, then I would love to hear from you. Please send them to Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com. Because I do review the material, and as often as I can, I will be using it. So here are some cute little items. Ever notice that people who are late are often much jollier than the people that have to wait for them? And most of us go to our grave with our music still inside of us. And this one I thought was cute. If Walmart is lowering prices every day, how come nothing is free yet? And this particular little statement is used by a friend of mine at the end of her newsletter. You may be the only one person in the world but you may also be the world to one person. And I think that that is so important. And some mistakes are too much fun to only make once. Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. And then this last one that Jessica sent is, we could learn a lot from crayons. Some are sharp, some are pretty, some are dull. Some have weird names, and all are different colors. But they all exist very nicely in the same box. And isn't that the truth? I think what makes life so very interesting is the fact that we are so different. Everybody has a wonderful story to share. Everybody has something that they can give in the way of experience and wisdom. Often it just takes the time to listen. And Della Reese is an actress that we all know about, and she's a very talented lady, been in entertainment for so many years. She talks about forgiveness, and I liked what she had to say about it. She said, my idea of forgiveness is letting go of the resentment that does not serve your better interest, ridding yourself of negative thoughts. All they do is make you miserable. Believe me, you can fret and fume all you want. But whoever it was that wronged you is not suffering from your anguish whatsoever. And I think those words of wisdom by Della are so important. So many times we hang on to our attitudes. Maybe something has happened in life and we've been hurt very deeply by a crude person's cruelty, selfishness, self-centeredness. And when we can, at a point, understand that we don't need to hang on to those feelings anymore, we can let them go and release them. It actually can liberate us. I think so many times we hang on to those feelings almost like a comfort blanket. And even though it produces agitation, we will hang on to them because we feel strange if we don't carry them around with us. It's like it justifies us being where we are, doing what we're doing, putting blame on someone else. When we can let go of that resentment, and I know it takes conscious attention, but when you can do that, then you're the one that's liberated. You're the one that is able to listen to the music that's inside of you and hear it clearly. So I think Della Reese had a nice bit of wisdom there, and I thought I would share that with you this morning. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. And by the way, all I need is your first name or your initial, and then I'll take it from there. Now, I was given, in fact, my husband gave me this. This was sent to him by a friend of his, and it's on WD-40. This is a product that's made in America, and I think just about, well, I can't say that every household in America has it, but a substantial amount do. And this is some real facts and information about this product that we have had in our home for years and have used it in so many different ways. But the product is called WD-40. It's actually, that's an abbreviation for water displacement number 40. Now, this product began from a search for a rust preventative solvent and a degreaser to protect missile parts. And WD-40 was created in 1953 by three technicians at the San Diego Rocket Chemical Company. The name comes from a project that was to find a water displacement compound. They were successful with their 40th formula, thus WD-40, water displacement number 40.
Hi, and Donna. Trigger,
oh, I've got a caller.
Yes, you do.
Well, my goodness, I didn't know you were there. Well, then we'll talk to you, and I'll finish the information about this wonderful product after we finish here. First name or initial, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Wisconsin.
From Wisconsin. Where in Wisconsin?
Green Bay.
Green Bay. One day I'm going to have to get back there. What's your first name, dear?
My first name is Jenny.
Sunny?
Jenny.
Denny?
Yes.
All right, Denny. Great. Okay. Now, the first thing I'm looking at with you is quite a bit of paperwork. It looks to me that you are working with a computer. There are some lessons of learning with this computer that you're going to be going through. But there's also a very important project. This is the word I will use. It is a project that is requiring that you really have all of your detail and points of information together. And you need to know that your patience in dealing with organizing all of this information that is going to later be put, and I'm seeing it in a folder. So I don't know if you're putting together a book, if it's a proposal of some kind for business. If it's a business plan, I don't know exactly what it is. I'm just seeing it in a folder. But doing it all on the computer is going to be so much easier for you because you're going to be able to go back and move things around easily, as you would want to do. You are a person that I think is going to be up in front of groups, frequently speaking. And I feel as if you are an educator. One of your passions is being able to communicate effectively and well with others. And one of your greatest senses of satisfaction is when you know that your instruction has enabled someone to do more with their life, with their attitudes, than they would have done without it. And I think this is very significant. Now, you've got a major shift in your life in 2007 relative to career. This seems to start evolving towards the end of winter, which is going to be naturally in 2007. And you are going to find yourself in a bit of a quandary, because you're going to say to yourself, gee, should I stay put or should I step into this brand new opportunity that's coming my way? And I would say step into the unknown. Go ahead, step into the opportunity. Because what is evolving here is that the last 11 years have given you skills and expertise that are enabling you to prepare yourself for this shift between now, this time in July, and April the 1st of next year, 2007, you're going to find monumental, giant steps forward in your own demonstration of capabilities and skills. People are going to be looking to you in many instances for you to do work that maybe they wouldn't have given to you before. So I have no doubts about you and your capabilities. I have no doubts about you and what you're going to feel in the sense of freedom by April the 1st of 2007. So don't mind, I say this and I mean it sincerely, don't mind this intense pressure you're feeling about yourself, because it's as if you're going through a tempering, a refinement process, so that you're going to be able to step into this opportunity by spring of next year. This is so important for you to be patient with what's going on around you. You need to deal with the facts, but be patient. You're doing well. Do you have a question for me?
You hit it right on the head. I've been going to school for a promotional or a step up in my career, and I've been testing for it. The last two times the test came through, and maybe it's just I need to wait and be patient.
Well, what did you go to school for, dear?
I'm going to school for probation and parole.
And where do you see yourself? Where would you like to be?
I would like to be an agent.
An agent.
I'm with the department right now in corrections. However, I've been going to school for it, and I submit my test, but I don't qualify yet, so.
All right. Now, we have to go to a break, dear. Will you stay on the line?
Sure.
Okay. We'll come back, and we'll be talking with Denny from Green Bay, Wisconsin, in just a bit. Now, don't you go away. You know the phone line is open, 877-876-5227, once we finish with this call. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Denny, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, something happened with the equipment. I'm noticing that the commercials didn't pop right in like they usually do. So let's go on with you instead of having dead air here. What I wanted to say to you is that with what you're looking at, with the environment that you're in at this time, I want you to be attentive to talking to people who have been in that environment, and ask them what recommendations they would make for you as you are in the process of wanting to qualify for a positioning. Also, what I would encourage you to do is see if you could do some volunteer work with someone that is actually doing what you want to be involved with. I am looking at you very much in an instructor kind of a positioning, and you may discover that there may be what I'd call a backdoor way to get in through being able to work, maybe in a different positioning than what you're looking at right now, in the interim.
Okay.
So I would try to find out about those individuals who are considered the best in the environment. Are you wanting to do this in Green Bay?
Yes, I am.
Well,
yes.
Since you have completed the course programming and you're going through the testing, then what I would do is just go down and ask someone directly to talk to the supervisor of the department that you would like to be involved with and tell them that you're a student and you would like to know what you could do to assist them and as a volunteer, since this is something you really have a strong interest in.
Okay.
What would they come up with?
Okay. I have a couple things up my sleeve right now.
Good for you. But just hang tight. Don't give up your dream, dear.
I won't.
And thank you, Denny. How did you learn about BBS Radio and the show?
Actually, the internet, working on the computer.
Wonderful.
So I listened to it through my computer, and then this is the first time I tried calling in, and I got through.
Well, I'm so glad that you did. Be sure and tell your friends now.
I sure will. I already have. Alrighty.
Spread the word out. Okay. Thank
Alrighty.
You for
Thank
calling.
You.
Have a
okay.
wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The telephone line is now open if you'd like to call in like Denny did, 877-876-5227. I was talking to you about WD-40. You know, I mentioned that it is an abbreviation for water displacement number 40, and the Corvair company bought this product in bulk to prevent their to protect their Atlas missile parts. And the workers that were working with it were so pleased with the product, they began smuggling it to use at home. It was also known as shrinkage, or a common word, stealing. Now, the executives, when they became aware of what their employees were doing, said, we might have a consumer market here. And they figured out a way of being able to put it into aerosol cans, and the rest, well, as it is most commonly said, is history. Now, it's a very carefully guarded recipe, and only four people know about it, and one of them is what they call the brewmaster of WD-40, and there's about 2.5 million gallons of WD-40 that's manufactured every single year, and its fragrance, if you've ever used it, I've used it, it is not unpleasant. It's a very nice fragrance, and they say it is something that is added to their concoction, the brew, and there's nothing in WD-40 that can hurt you. Now, they say if you want to test it, if you really want to test it, you might want to try it on your shower door, because it's the first thing that's ever cleaned a spotty shower door, and if you've got a plastic one, it works just as well as glass. It just gets it squeaky clean. And you can try it on your stovetop. I remember someone telling me about using it. Like if you had your house up for sale and you wanted everything to really sparkle, go and use it on your faucets and polish them. They'll look like they're brand new. I tried it. It works. It can protect silver from tarnishing. Believe it or not, it can clean and lubricate guitar strings. And it gives floors a just wax sheen without making them slippery. Now, for those of you that are farmers in the world, it'll keep your flies off your cows. Yes, we all need to know about that. And it also restores and cleans chalkboards. And it goes on and on and on. This is absolutely amazing. What is just, it's a product that, like I said, so many of us use, we don't even think twice about it. And do you know what? The basic ingredient in it, remember they said it will not hurt you? The basic ingredient is fish oil. Try to figure that one out. So, good old fish oil. Someone found an application for it. that is non-toxic, and we can use it every place and any place, and it's just fine. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. Now, I wanted to share something with you. This is a poem by Louise Pinkerton Fritz, and I liked it. It's summertime, and this is what it's relating to. Summer days are here again. We see them everywhere. They're written on the emerald grass and in the balmy air. We see them in the wild grapevines that hug the towering trees and in the painted butterflies that flutter in the breeze. That's Louise Pinkerton Fritz. Wonderful little poem there that I think is just so descriptive of summer. And isn't it wonderful when you're out and about? My husband and I, we like to walk, and we'll do like 5 miles when we go out for a walk. And you know what's so nice when you're out walking? You meet people, you say hello, how are you? And you get to meet people and their dogs and talk to them. We met a little Karen Terrier this morning, whose name was Misty. It's just such a joy. During this summer, people are out and about, and there's just this wonderful openness that you have. So when you feel sort of frustrated as if the world is closing in on you, get on your walking shoes, go out and walk around the neighborhood. You may find that you end up making some very good friends and just meet some really nice people. And, of course, you have to be open to say hello. It just makes a difference. Now, do you know that blueberries are one of the best antioxidant fruits that you could ever eat? And here in the Pacific Northwest, we just absolutely love blueberries. We love berries of all kinds. And, of course, they're out abundantly in the stores right now. Well, I don't know about you, but they just seem to have a special magic for pancakes. I love blueberry pancakes, and I like a blueberry syrup. And here is... I have my own recipe, and maybe one day I'll share that with you. But here's a real quick sauce. If you wanted to fix a nice breakfast or maybe a dinner. Have you ever had pancakes for dinner? Great stuff to have. Well, here's a blueberry sauce that's real easy to make. And all you need is half a cup of sugar, a tablespoon of cornstarch, two cups of blueberries. And this is how easy this is. You, in a 2-quart pan, you combine your sugar, your cornstarch, and then gradually stir in about a third of a cup of water. And then you add your berries, and you want to keep stirring this. And you bring it to a boil over medium heat. Boil for about a minute, stirring occasionally, and just serve it warm or cold. Keeps nicely in the refrigerator over your favorite blueberry pancake recipe. And you know, it's good over ice cream, too. Really good over ice cream. So that's just a little tip for you regarding blueberries. And, oh my goodness, we're almost out of time. Well, I want to remind you again, tomorrow's Saturday. You want to have fun. We've got a weekend to enjoy here. But on Monday, we're going to be talking with Jerry Winstrom, the Inspired Heart. And he's going to be sharing some wonderful insights with us. Also, I want to let those of you know who are listening in the state of Washington, the Renaissance Fantasy Fair is going to be coming up out in Gig Harbor. Go into my website, DelphiInternational.com. That's Delphi, D-E-L-P-H, International, P-H-I, excuse me, International.com. And you'll be able to find out all of the information on this wonderful event, and I will be appearing there all 3 weekends in August. That's coming up in August. Well, it's the end of this wonderful hour. I'm going to thank you for being with me. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Just set yourself free. Enjoy your day. Hey, it's a nice one. Who knows? You may just have a wonderful, wonderful, joyous experience with an unknown you never expected. Donna Sebo here. We'll talk to you on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.